Hello, Joel here. I've got a new book out. It's called Be Funny or Die: How Comedy Works and Why It Matters. And it's about how comedy works and why it matters. Why human beings tell jokes, and then what that tells us about being human beings. So if you're a human being and you enjoy laughing and then want to know what the hell's going on with that, it's probably a pretty good book to read. It's called Be Funny or Die. It's in shops. You can buy it.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Cheese and Pickle.
Hello, this is Comfort Blanket and I'm Joel Morris. I'm going to be talking to someone who makes cool stuff that I like about some warm stuff that they like. A book or a TV show or a film or a record they go back to again and again for comfort. This time I'm talking to the writer and actor Larry Rickard, best known for Ghosts and Yonderland and Bill and Horrible Histories and all that sort of thing. This is part two of a two-part chat about the sitcom Friends. So if you've missed part one, go back and listen to that one first, because this will make sense. We're still doing it in English. We'll be talking about a show you've heard of called Friends, but it's better if you do it from the beginning, because that's the order we talked about it. So yeah, go back. Otherwise, if you have heard part one, this is part two. Enjoy.
Because it's particularly strange that new generation have found it and completely get it and embrace it. And at the same time, are like, oh, my God, I can't believe they're doing 90% of what they're doing.
Yeah.
Because, you know, some things about it are problematic. Some are right on the cusp of being problematic. And I think nothing shows the gulf of time that a couple of decades can be than looking at something with huge cultural resonance. And, you know, something which is big and broad and is watched by lots and lots of people. And to the point that, like I say, it's being repeated in the mornings on Channel 4. It wasn't like, oh, my God, this thing is really, you know, it's not like you're listening to a Derek and Clive album and then going, God, that was offensive. But there were so many things in it where a few years pass and you go, oh, I'm not sure we should have been doing that.
Wow, you look just like your son, Mrs. Tribbiani.
What? Are you referring to my man's bag?
At first, I thought it just looked good, but it's practical, too. Check it out. It's got compartments for all your stuff. Your wallet, your keys,
your address book, your makeup.
And that's an interesting thing, I think, with comedy. People are constantly obsessed, certainly now, obsessed with what you can and can't say. And the answer is, you should say anything that gets a laugh. That's what you're aiming for. You're trying to make your audience happy. The only thing you can find out by watching old comedy isn't what the comedians and writers were like. You find out what the audiences were like. Yeah. It's taking the temperature of the planet. And the thing that we should look at is, you know, I can't believe those awful people made that awful comedy. You go, I can't believe we were awful.
I didn't even have a chance to act as though I'm okay with it.
You should feel, hopefully, that we've become kinder and softer and more understanding.
Give Daddy the Barbie. Okay,
how about, don't you want to play with a monster truck?
But it doesn't mean that the show is terrible. In fact, it's quite useful to watch the show and find out how recently we changed.
Dude, don't do that to me.
Oh, no, it's cool. You can stay here. My parents won't mind.
No, it's not that. I just don't want to be stuck here all night with your fat sister.
This is the thing. I think because it's so tempting to go, oh, have you seen that show that those terrible people made that said all those awful things? And you go, well, it went through what would have been a very, very nervous and quite constrictive production company because it's an American network show and, you know, they do not like to say, oh, just make whatever you want and send it in.
The advertisers will have approved
of it. The advertisers, compliance, all of the channels it's being sold to, you know, there would have been so, so many eyes on it. And people are going, yeah, yeah, that's all fine.
I'm Rachel. I'm a friend of Monica and Chandler's.
I'm Amanda.
Oh, I get it. Amanda. duh.
That's the jokes we make.
Yeah.
These are what we find funny. You see yourself reflected in the screen whenever you watch comedy and whenever you laugh, because you're trying to make everyone in the room. It's a live comedy with an audience, and that audience needs to keep laughing.
Yeah.
So that whole audience has to be in agreement that these are our values. This is what we think about gay people.
Do you want a date Saturday?
Yes, please.
Okay. He is cute. He's funny.
He's a he?
Well, yeah. Oh, God. I just...
You don't get any laughs unless everyone's in agreement. No one's pushing a boundary and making people think of something new. The sound of consensus laughter is why it was a massive hit. So I think it's really good for our kids to watch it and go, that's what we were like.
Don't you have a little too much penis to be wearing a dress like that?
Like, I might watch Carry On, though. Is that what you found funny?
Yeah.
I don't want them to not show those things.
No,
I want
absolutely.
To look at them and laugh.
Yeah.
So how goes the dancing? Gay yet?
And also, you know, it's a little bit, there's a bit of archaeology about it, looking at things which have changed and going, isn't it interesting that that used to seem completely okay?
There is nothing you could put on a list that would ever make me not want to be with you.
Well, then I guess that's the difference between us. See, I'd never make a list.
The things that you would have guessed maybe in 20 years' time, I wonder whether that sort of line will still be landing. Yeah. Absolutely fine. Things that you probably thought were completely inane. And you go, good God, who knew that that would be an issue in two decades?
Rachel and I hired a male nanny.
Really? Guys do that? That's weird.
Thank you!
Yeah, it's like a woman wanting to be a...
A what? A what? What's the end of that sentence?
Yes, what is the end of that sentence?
A penis model.
It wasn't like they were thinking, this is touch and go, but I think we should do this bit of material because it's important. It was just a gag and a laugh. But it's weird. It's somehow different with comedy. That I suppose it's because it's light and it's frivolous and it's making you laugh and it's an entertainment.
Yeah.
That you're not given the same license as you are with the drama. Obviously, everyone's watching a 1960s James Bond going, this guy's awful. But it's not sort of shouted down and railed against in the same way as it would be if you're watching a comedy of that period, because it's not trying to be light and fun. And you're going, no, you're not being light and fun because you've done something wrong. If it's trying to be dark and gritty and it ends up being dark and gritty in a slightly different way, it's sort of less offensive to your sensibilities. And
that's a great point.
Made laugh.
It says something about how comedy works, and comedy does work by consensus. You have to get, especially a live comedy, everyone in the room to agree it's funny.
Yeah, yeah.
So the moment you drop in a joke now and the person at home is going, why are those guys laughing? That's not funny.
Yeah.
Then you feel that the tribe split up and you feel a bit isolated. You're going, is it just me who finds that offensive?
Yeah.
So I think it is, you're right, it is weird. You can watch an old drama, you can watch The Sweeney and enjoy it and not mind that it's sexist, because those guys, I'm not meant to agree with everything they say.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas with a comedy, to laugh, you have to agree with the values.
Absolutely.
And it's especially an audience comedy.
Wow, you guys sure have a lot of books about being a lesbian.
I think as well that it's weird how things get pushed in two directions in terms of what's acceptable. Things either go, that seemed absolutely fine at the time, and now that seems really offensive. Or you'll look at something like the Sex Pistols swearing on Reg Grundy and you go, God, was that? Really?
Is that bad?
Like, I reckon if they'd have gone out there making friends and are just like, we're going to make the most offensive sitcom we possibly can, now we'd be looking at it and going, God, isn't it quaint that they thought that was offensive?
What are you guys doing?
We're just hanging out by the spoons. Ladle?
Will you guys grow up? This is the most natural, beautiful thing in the world.
Yeah, we know, but there's a baby sucking on it.
Yeah, the other thing that struck me about it, looking back on it, is because of where it was set, you know, that it, and the fact that they're in a nice part of Manhattan as well, they justify that by it being, you know, a rent-controlled flat that she's somewhat dubiously inherited from her grandparents, that it meant that there's nothing about their look or their costume which gives you any clues to help you understand them as characters.
Yeah.
And normally, you know, Ghost is obviously the extreme example that when you see what the captain wears, you're expecting a certain sort of character, and that gives you a shorthand. When you see someone whose head's being cut off, you go, right, they're a little bit unlucky. You've got a fop with big floppy hair. You go, I wonder if they're really vain. And even, you know, not being that extreme, but if you see the way that, you know, that Del Boy's coat and hat and Rodney's sort of anorak, you've just got a lot of clues. And even when you've got a very nerdy character like the paleontologist.
Electrifying. Infinite time.
There's a Starbucks about three blocks down.
Not being coded, you know, hasn't got greased back hair and a bow tie and, you know, thick rim glasses. They could almost be wearing each other's costumes, with the possible exception of Phoebe, because she's slightly new age and hippie-ish. There's a degree to which they give her a costume that slightly sits with that, and she's not as off the peg as the others. But otherwise, they're kind of interchangeable. And so, again, you're having to do more work to establish them as rounded characters because there's no shorthand to it.
That's incredible. What that gives you as well is that it immediately sets up a situation where there's no pecking order. It's a very classless show.
Yeah.
Their relationship is only to other people outside. The people outside the group give them challenges of status. But within the six, they're all of equal status.
Yeah.
There's none of them. There's not ones who are older or younger. Again, for an ensemble to have everyone the same age, in the same clothes, of the same socioeconomic background.
And Rachel equally beautiful.
Rachel, there's no sense in which any of them are stuck in a role of being alpha or beta or their aspirations. What it gives you is a chessboard of pieces that can move anywhere.
Yeah.
Because they're all equal.
This is an informative night for me because I always thought the ensemble award was a wardrobe award. And Matt LeBlanc and David Schwimmer and Jennifer Aniston, I know, couldn't be here tonight because they're doing publicity for the show, and thank God for that. Because we got to get a way to get this show out there so that people know that it's about friends who drink some coffee and say funny things.
And that also creates the thing that, well, of course, was Friends' secret weapon, is that any of them could date any of them.
Yeah, and boy, did they realise that over, you know, 10 seasons. That's...
Well, I think they were originally going to try and do a Joey and Monica as the, maybe coded by the ones with the darkest hair they would date.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you pair them up? But they were going to do that, and they decided that it was going to be Ross and Rachel.
Mm.
And watching again, I didn't realise Ross and Rachel was not added. It is seeded in episode one. Mm.
You know, you probably didn't know this, but back in high school, I had a major crush on you.
I knew.
You did? Oh.
There's so many things where you think of plot threads which are really delved into in series 3, series 4, series 5, and you look back at the first two episodes and go, they were threading that then.
It's incredibly
clever. You know,
that
was being seeded,
And it set up a thing that obviously everyone knows, that the big revolution that happened in American sitcom was when they realised Will They Won't They worked.
Yeah.
And you do Sam and Diane or David and Maddie in Moonlighting, and you go, oh, people will come back to watch whether a couple will fall in love, Niles and Daphne. It works really well. It's a breakaway from Story of the Week, a breakaway from the secret weapon of sitcom, was it was episodic and you could watch any episode in any order. That set up immediately. I was stunned by the craft of it and the braveness of the craft of it, in that episode one, episode two, episode three end without a punchline.
Mm.
But they end with a plot line.
Yeah.
See ya.
Mm-hmm. Wait, wait. Hey, what's with you?
I just grabbed a spoon.
You don't end on the biggest laugh. That's in your over the titles thing.
Mm-hmm.
But you end and there's a cliffhanger
to
say, oh, and you don't laugh. It's not a laugh line. You are invited as an audience to go, wonder where this is going.
It's a streaming sitcom before streaming.
And that's why I think when I talk to my niece, who's a huge Friends fan, she looks at it as a streaming sitcom, as long arc relationship thing. And I only realised it watching it for this. I went, I don't think I've binged five episodes of Friends in a row, but oh my God, it's a streaming sitcom.
And they have proper, you know, arcs that go across, some of them go across whole series, some sit across parts of the series. And you'll have two or three running at the same time, whether it's about Monica and her job in the restaurant, you know, how mean the people are being to her, which runs across, you know, a whole half of the series, whether it's the Ross and Rachel thing, which certainly bridges across two seasons, arguably across all 10.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet, the fact that, you know, they code all those episodes, even by the names, are going, it's the one where it's also unashamedly a dip in, dip out.
Yeah.
In isolation, story of the week. Nothing that's happening in the individual episode stories crash into the longer narrative threads in play. You can dip in and out of any episode, enjoy it and laugh without having to go, I don't understand what's happening here. There's just enough depth in the longer narrative arcs that they hook you enough to want to come back for more, but they don't exclude you if you haven't seen the context of episodes either side. And it's really hard to find that line, I think.
I don't want to get over her.
What?
I don't. I want to be with her.
Really?
Yeah, I'm going to go after her.
I think, it's probably one of the greatest examples of that ever, because after this, the temptation with streaming, the fact that people are going to binge, is to go, we'll go all out in the long arcs. We will seed them like little breadcrumbs, and that will be the main reason you come back is to follow those. I think this is one of the great last examples of a story of the week sitcom that has incredibly strong arcs that you can, as you say, watch anyone in any order and you won't be lost. And the thing with comedy, more than drama, is confusion is the enemy.
Yeah.
If you don't know how everyone's going to be, you occasionally get it with sitcoms where they have got these long arcs. I sometimes switch on a Frasier and I have to remember whether this is before or after Daphne and Niles. No.
Yes.
And you go, I don't want any of that. I want this to be in some lovely state of stasis where every time I drop in, I know where they all sit on the board, what all their roles are. Mm. The clarity is everything. I mean, if you're working in sitcom now, the need to have both must be really challenging.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. What's going on? You and I just made out. You and I are making out?
Well, not anymore.
I think you always pulled slightly in two directions. And also you want to have some sense of development so that you're not so stuck in stasis that you go, series five is exactly the same as series one and there's no sense of growth or development there. But it's so easy. We've had, there were times on Ghosts where we discussed plot arcs that were going to go across series where we would then stop ourselves, even when they were relatively well developed, and go, that's too much and that's too thick.
Yeah.
And it would overwhelm the stories of the week and then it becomes a different format. And we love the fact that episodes stand alone and you never want to sort of feel like those stories are playing second fiddle to the stuff that should just be deep background.
It's the joy of comedy. It's one of the things that comedy does brilliantly. And increasingly, I know several people who've been submitting scripts recently and been told, don't do story of the week for comedy. And you go, but that's the art form.
Yeah.
The art form is that you should drop in on a sitcom or a comedy and know who everyone is. The stasis is the joy. The familiarity. People say this about situation comedy and they think the situation is the house or the job.
Yeah.
What it is, it's a series of fixed characters who are challenged by a different situation every week. The situation is the plot.
Yeah, yeah.
As in, everything's fixed. The space they're in, how they react, and you throw different things at them. And that's what the audience enjoy watching.
I think that's the problem with this pull towards more narrative stuff, is that ultimately, story of that type invites you to develop and change and have a starting point and an end point. And the only way you can have those changes and developments is to stop things from being the same and make them different. And then you go, this isn't the show I bought into.
Yeah.
It's that thing of, there are sometimes people who make kind of requests of the show, fans of the show going, it would be really lovely to see that happen. Or Mike to suddenly be able to see all of the ghosts, or this ghost to come back, that ghost to disappear. And you go, you think you want that, but what that then does is change the thing that works about it.
I'm going to see a caveman!
Yeah, okay, I need help.
What you're enjoying is the stability and the predictability. And what you're mistaking there is story and narrative, which you like in drama. And we all like story and narrative.
Yeah.
Story and narrative has change in it. That's why a film works or a play or a book is that someone might be changed. A unique thing in comedy is familiarity and the fixedness of people. And the reason that everyone says a sitcom should be people trapped somewhere. That's why Ghosts work so well. It's why Friends work so well. What people say, I want change. And you went, did you like the later series where they changed the cast? Do you like the series of Community where there's a different group of people in it? Or were you annoyed when that happened? Because what happens is everyone bitches about it. When you go, someone left to go and be in something else and you put in a replacement. Do you like it when they recast someone? Or whether you say, that character leaves and his brother comes in and it's someone else and they switch it up. Everyone objected when Diane left Cheers and Rebecca Kirstie Alley came in.
Yeah.
Well, the dynamics roughly the same, but it was slightly different. Mm. Those changes, which everyone says they want because they are yearning for story to happen to the character they love. What they don't realise is that the writers and production team are trying to trap everyone in amber so that every time you tune in, that carefully balanced machine runs exactly the same way as it did last time, because that's what you're enjoying, predicting what's going to happen, and it's still surprising you.
Yes, that is, I think that's exactly what it is. It's that fine balance between surprise and predictability. And that is what is so finely tuned about comedy in a way that it doesn't need to be about drama.
Yeah.
I'm not saying drama's easier, but...
But you are.
But, no, but you know, yeah, drama's about change and development.
Yeah.
And going, where's the story going? Where's the story going? And particularly because normally, where, you know, often American long-running dramas start to fall down is that a drama, a story within a drama invites a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Yeah.
And normally what they have to do in order to work in that network framework is go, I've got a beginning, I've got some idea of a middle, and now what we need to do is endlessly hold off the end so that we can do another series, another series, another series. And then the idea of it being a story falls apart because it goes, we've got the beginning, then we've got the beginnings of a middle, and then a really long middle, and then a complicated bit of more middle. And
everyone loves middle. Oh, don't people love middle?
No. Yeah, and of course, everyone who started at the beginning was goes, God, I'm looking forward to the end. And they go, it will either never come, or when it gets there, you'll hate it.
Yeah, because you'll be so sick of the middle. I remember talking to one of the writers on Succession, and I said, how's it going? And they smiled and said, yeah, still doing Act One, Scene One of King Lear. Then divide up the empire. We have worked out a million variations on Act One, Scene One of King Lear. I think it's one of the most perfect examples of how to blend those two things.
Oh, my God.
Total sitcom bones. It's written by sitcom masters. They knew how to do it.
That's the thing that you can... Sorry, I'm not going to... Go on. Anyway, this was a podcast about Friends, but now it's about Succession. Quite right. Genuinely watching that. I mean, I watched the first episode, and it was one of those things where I stood up at the end and was like, yes! Because you can tell that that's someone who's grounded in sitcom, and the amount of story and intrigue is there, but also it is genuinely properly funny.
Yeah.
And it's pulling you along and pulling you along, but you never feel that you're being strung along. It always feels like it is building to something. It is going somewhere. And then it was, you know, at the end, it went.
No, but it's how it works is it is generous and rewarding to an audience. And that is what that show, Succession, has got in common with Friends and Ghosts, is that if you've worked out who these characters are, the treat for you as an audience is to watch them do the things you know they're going to do.
Yeah.
And every time a joke comes in, it might bounce surprisingly off someone you're not expecting. Mm. It might go off in an angle you're not expecting, but no one acts out of character.
Yeah.
You were given all the tools to know exactly how Phoebe or the captain or Roman will react.
Yeah.
And the joy of sitcom is not as much to do with plot and change as to do with character and essence.
Look at me, I'm Chandler. Could I be wearing any more clothes?
I think as well, because you're used to in sitcom dealing with, you know, the thing that makes people funny is the things that they do wrong, the mistakes they make, the flaws they get.
Yes.
Whereas in drama, the idea is, right, you've got some bad guys who do bad things, and then you've got good guys who do good things. And the bravery in that to go against sort of the, you know, conventional edicts and go, there's no one in here who's... There's nobody in this is good. But human nature is such is that you will try and grasp... You will look at one of them and your brain will be going, one of them do something tiny that can make me go, maybe you're the good person and I come back.
So if there was a list of 7 billion people on this planet that Dad would choose to be boss, we know you would be last.
Dad fired you, man.
No, he did not fire me. He said it was just going to take a little longer.
But he said that to be nice. What I think he meant to say was that he wished that Mom gave birth to a can opener, because at least then it would be useful.
And I remember there would be points in different series there where I'd suddenly go, oh, that one I think is okay. That's the horse that I'm going to hitch my dreams to. And then the next episode you go, oh, they're as bad as the rest.
That applies in all sitcoms. You are watching them, and the idea in all great sitcoms is your favourite should constantly change.
Yeah.
And I love that. We came to the screening of Ghosts recently and people are dressed up as their favourite. And I went, I hope that changes all the time.
Yeah.
Because characters are flawed, because they are letting you down all the time, you will change who your favourite is. And whenever I watch Friends, the thing I really enjoy about it is as the lines bounce around, I change my idea of who my favourite is.
Yeah.
Rachel claims this is her favourite movie.
Dangerous Liaisons.
Correct. Her actual favourite movie is...
Weekend at Bernie's.
Correct.
And it's usually who last made me laugh.
Yeah.
Monica categorises her towels. How many categories are there?
Everyday use.
Fancy.
Guest.
Fancy guest. 2 seconds. 11.
Absolutely. And I think with an ensemble sitcom, you have to give people that chance to shine.
Chandler was how old when he first touched a girl's breast?
14?
No, 19.
Thanks, man.
It means in certain episodes, you just go, this is a showpiece, a tour de force for Joey.
Yeah.
And so you're going to come out there and go, that is the greatest character.
Joey had an imaginary childhood friend. His name was...
Maurice.
Correct. His profession was...
Oh, space cowboy!
Correct!
But when you watch the next episode, you go, this is a tremendous episode for Chandler or Monica, and you come out the end going, God, they're good, aren't they?
What is Chandler Bing's job?
Oh, gosh!
10 seconds, you need this or you lose the game.
It has something to do with transponding. Oh, he's a transponster!
You know, the same people often ask me about Ghost and say, who's your favourite character? And every time I think I think it's this one, I'll think back to another episode we did or another moment that really made me laugh. And I'll go, actually, no, it's that character. And I like that even I can't be certain about who my favourite is on something that I sort of helped create.
You get up in the morning and you can wear whatever you like. Thomas is wearing double denim with aviators.
So.
And Mary is wearing a dress made out of seashells.
With a simple lobster hat.
Really healthy. I mean, there was obviously the fuss that was made about Friends was that as it went on and it became more and more successful, these people became enormously rich and enormously powerful. And the big story was always how much they were earning. And it was never that they were all earning the same. Because it's a team.
Yeah.
And you find with these shows that when they're a team show, that the cast are very loyal to each other and they talk about it being a family.
Yeah.
And you hear about it on good sitcoms all the time, that there's a sense of in front of the camera and behind the camera that no one is jockeying for position. And the audience feels that when they watch it, that no one's jockeying for dominance for the laughs. Yeah. That it's a team game, that you're watching the ball bounce between people and they're all in position to play the game. You're watching a team.
That's how they do pits. First they go up one side, they move it over, then they go up the other side, they move it back, and then they do the rear. What? Ross, will you tell him? Isn't that how a tailor measures pants?
Yes, it is. In prison.
What you're loving about it is the flat hierarchy.
Yeah.
Which you said, they're all dressed the same. They're all from the same background. So it's a flat hierarchy. So it's not a star show.
No.
And also, that feels healthy.
Normally, or often with ensembles, it can be that no matter how much you go in thinking you're making an ensemble, a star emerges.
Yeah.
And you never, you know, sometimes it's obvious from day one. Other times it takes a while to come out. With the exception of Rachel's hair.
Yeah.
If you look at, say, Happy Days, you go, there's an ensemble sitcom, but you go, well, Fonzie.
Yeah.
You know, Henry Winkler is a standout star from that show. There's a winner, yeah.
And I'm sure their agent starts to go, well, you know who the breakout star is. Who's getting the toys? Yeah. Who's getting the merchandise? Friends, remarkably for a show that's commercialised like it was, right to the end, feels like a level playing field.
Yeah, yeah.
And what you're watching, I suppose, is something very warming and comforting, which is Friends. I mean, it's called Friends, but they're not fighting each other for dominance like Friends wouldn't. And it's based clearly on friendships that the writers had to say, sometimes there's a gang of you and not a star, which is a very un-Hollywood way of telling a story. They love a star because then you can get your agent to negotiate more money.
Yeah.
But that fairness, maybe it's a lovely show to watch because I don't know about you, I always feel like I might not be the most popular person in any group of friends.
No, I'm the opposite.
You think you're always, everyone does.
Again, let's talk about the Beatles again, but there was always that sense, that, I mean, I think they've talked about it. I can't remember whether it was Ringo and George who both sort of said at one point they were like, you know, when it was all over, or certainly when it was all falling apart, when it was always the three of you and me on the outside, and the other one went, I always thought it was the three of you and me on the outside. And I think to a degree it's human nature. And I'm sure there might well have been that sense amongst them where one of them sort of felt like they were the one that was more on the periphery of the group. Because it never felt like that, certainly not as a viewer.
And it held together. And it held together for 10 seasons because of that. There's not a sense that any one of them can fly off. They didn't do that. No one left. No one came back.
No.
It's a very solid group. And maybe that's a nice thing to watch. Because obviously we're talking about a show called Friends. It will be an analogue for how you feel about yourself in your group of friends. As in, you pick your favourite, you identify, oh, I'm a bit of a Phoebe or whatever, you might feel that. Or my friend she's such a Rachel. You're identifying with it. What it is a story about how those friends hold together.
Yeah.
And those actors, those incredibly privileged, pampered, maybe troubled actors, held together.
Yeah.
The show held together under that pressure, and that's a nice thing to watch. The reason it's funny is they're all still equal. It remained an ensemble.
Yeah.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss. There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I never worked out whether it was a blessing or a curse to be the way in which a show is put together, particularly something like that, where on screen they were like, my God, you guys just, you've got this thing and it's lightning in the bottle and you get along so well. Whether you then feel that pressure to go, that's what we're really like. When it's not like you met at high school, it's you're all cast into this show and the chances that you'll all be the sort of people who, beyond the lines that your characters have been given, get along and gel, and all of you do. I mean, that was always, you know, the reason why, you know, my little gang have kept doing things for as long as we have is that we realised how rare it is to people to be thrown together into a show and going, oh my God, these people are all great and I love spending time with them.
Yeah, you were assembled as a cast to do a job.
Yeah.
And it turned out that your platoon was very, very strong.
Yeah.
And that's what these guys are. I mean, is there a bit of this that you're watching it because you can identify with that feeling of being an unbreakable ensemble that is completely by chance?
Yeah, maybe it is that. I wonder if it's in some ways tricky that people sort of go, you're all thrown together and what are the chances of you getting along? But you go, you're thrown together in a format which is saying, and now you all need each other and you need to get along.
Yeah.
But whereas in some ways, if you'd have been one of these groups that naturally forms because of people you know at school, you don't feel that same sense of, oh, this is something important that needs to be protected. And you might just fall out because friends fall out when you're friends first and then you find something that you can all do together as a job. It's a friendship first and foremost, and those can fall apart. Whereas if you go, this is a job and has a format and a structure to it which needs to be preserved, and then out of that a friendship grows, that maybe that's the easier version to preserve. I don't know.
It's standards, isn't it? It's Great Britain. You know, Breton. Yeah. Hey, I haven't told you my jumbo jet, Joe.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say there's probably not about to be a bear.
Whoa. It's tricky, right?
It's tricky.
Who wrote that?
One second.
Sorry, Robin's got to turn off his iPhone.
Robin's got to turn off his
Can you play best friends until you become best friends? And your job is to do this, the gang together thing. You're thrown together to do a job. Mm. But the bonding that happens with that job is incredible. I remember making a short film with a friend who used to fit windows as a builder, ex-builder. He said his experience was making TV and films and doing construction work were the most intense friendships he'd ever had.
Because
you have a job to do, you have to build something. It's really hard, it's long hours, it's tiring, and you've got to not let each other down.
Yeah.
And you get that when you bump into people, especially at award ceremonies, and you see the people who've been through making a thing, and you go, you look like a bunch of people who built a house, who raised a barn, like an Amish thing.
Yeah.
It's amazing if you're thrown together as a bunch of misfits, is how all crews are.
Yes.
You didn't know each other before Monday and you're thrown together, and as you said, when you're doing Ghost Stories, is it 3 months away from your family?
Yeah.
You better get on.
Yeah.
Ah, Alison, there you are. Would you mind putting Guernsey's Nazi Past on the VCR for me, please?
Excuse me, I haven't watched my book. I'm run out of breath, sorry.
Maybe what you're watching with friends is the fantasy of Hollywood's slickest, vainest, most ego-driven industry created a thing.
Yeah. You've got to be a gang now. You've got to be a team.
Yeah,
well,
basically, you mustn't compete. You must be.
Yeah,
it does feel collegiate. The warmth of it is in the fact that they've managed to last 10 seasons without them pulling each other apart.
Okay, pivot! 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 Shut up! Shut up! Shut up!
normally what happens, which I think is why when it works, you hold it so tight, is you either all get on and make something terrible, or you don't get on and make something brilliant. Those tend to be the sort of... And so when they came together, started making this show, you get into that sort of siege mentality and everyone starts to get along and working as a family, like, say, building a house. And then out of that, quite quickly, suddenly the success comes, and this incredible success. And, you know, there was that sense that it could be like that. They were taken out by, I can't remember whether it was the one of the writers or execs on the show, the cast were taken out for dinner just before it. The first episode went out, and they just sort of said to them, oh, this will be the last time you'll be able to do this. And, you know, that sense that they are the only six people who understand what it's like to be the cast of Friends. And that probably gives you a camaraderie which can't be replicated, you know. Because how life-changing in the best and worst ways that must be, yeah. That scale of fame.
It was nice for, I don't know, 4 or 5 months, and then it got a little surreal. You start to miss the fact that you can just kind of be in a crowd and walk around. It got a little strange.
I think each of us reacted differently to it. I was, I don't know, I did not respond well to it. I felt it a real invasion of privacy, someone just walking up and grabbing you, or...
You know, you should have taken off your Friend's cape.
Yeah. And the show itself is about that.
Yeah.
It's about holding together.
Yeah, yeah.
And the agony towards the end where you realise they're going to have to fly apart.
Yeah.
Because this is a show not about a situation or a place or a high concept, but about a time.
Mm.
What's the high concept of Friends? They're 20-something.
Yeah.
They haven't settled down. What are you hoping from episode one? Well, I hope Ross and Rachel get together. Right, yeah. You're hoping the show ends.
God, yeah. That's
so it's
so weird.
Baked into it.
Yes. That's true. It starts by going... Everything you like about this is going to die.
So it's about the importance is you're watching, you want simultaneously it to finish and it to go on forever, which is how you feel about the best sitcoms, I think.
And now, here we are with our future before us. And I only want to spend it with you. My prince, my soulmate, my friend.
And also, I mean, I know the American system cares about this less anyway, because, you know, it's sort of like, if the commission comes and they want some more, you make some more, because it is so industrial. And so I don't know whether or not who made that decision to go, 10 is plenty. But it actually ends in a way that's massively, it felt really satisfying to me that they were still friends, but they weren't those people in their 20s where their friends is their family. They were together and they were in couples and they were having families of their own and they were doing that inevitable thing of splitting up. But still, the fact that it ends with them going off downstairs to have that coffee in the place they always go, the sense you got was they will be like those group of friends ends up being as you get into your 30s, 40s. It doesn't change. It becomes less intense and it becomes less frequent. But you got that sense that they would still be coming back together, that they'd meet up and it might be two or three of them meeting up rather than all six. And, oh, someone's got to babysit. Oh, and they're out of the country on business. But they'll be... But still, when you got that sense of when the six of them got back together, when the diaries coalesced and they all got back together, that it would still be a tight group of friends. And I think that sort of... That felt like it rung true. I thought it was very nicely handled. It didn't try and do something... too big or dramatic. It just said life moves on.
We got some time. Okay, should we get some coffee?
Sure. Okay. Where?
Well, obviously, the elephant in the room here is that you're just about to say goodbye to Ghosts.
Yeah.
So basically, you've created a sitcom where the entire sit was that people can't move on.
Yeah.
And you decided after 5 seasons to stop it.
Yeah.
Your own decision, not anyone else's. And you're about to say goodbye to those characters for a start, but maybe those people for a bit. And maybe the same thing, you'll be in the same situation as those Friends guys. The only people who know what it's like to make this thing, all the things that you've made together, you are about to get to a point where maybe the coffee shop won't have everyone in.
What a terrible, terrible mistake. Yeah. You know, it's so hard to know when the time's right, particularly when we've been so lucky with Ghost that it found an audience, and that's the rarest thing. You know, and it landed in a way that we never thought it would. And despite we've been more across the production in an overarching way than we've been able to with anything before, and it could so easily have been that those pressures made it a different experience and not as pleasurable, but it's been such a joy. And I think because of that, the impetus to not let it go wrong or go stale or get worse, that the feeling that we wanted to protect it as a thing, you know, me as a person, as a writer, as an actor, I love making it so much. I think I would have just gone on doing it forever. And the inevitable trajectory of anything on television is downward. It's only how long you can stay on the crest. And you never know where the crest is. You might go, oh, we're on the crest, and then you do another series and it goes up a bit further. Normally you get a sense of when you're on a crest, and it's how long you can plateau. And those plateaus don't tend to be massively long. And so it was like going, the thing that we felt we were sacrificing was the ease and the fun of going, let's just keep doing this. But it was to preserve the quality of the thing that we were making and avoiding the risk of going, what if it starts to tail off? What if it starts to go downhill? What if now we've done the stories of how everyone, all of those ghosts ended up in the house, the inevitable format change? What if that change made it less good? And
you're preserving a status. You're trying to do a thing that you're talking about here. Two sitcoms at once in a way that I wasn't expecting us to be doing. But I think it works really well. You've had a massive popular hit that people invest a lot in, and it's an ensemble piece about equal distribution of plot and status and everything. Very similar to Friends, about a bunch of friends. I've seen a couple of episodes of the new series, and there's a real focus on, it's not about the house, it's about the friends. Even Fanny, the one for whom the house is most important, says, it's about the people, not the house.
Yeah.
It's about friends. And what you're talking about there isn't just the characters in the show. It's about you as a bunch of friends. And then we found in talking about friends, we actually ended up talking about the actors as a bunch of equal friends making a thing. There are parallels all along this, and it's about saying, do you want to stop doing this in order to preserve your happiness at doing it?
Yeah.
And your happiness with each other and the feeling that you did something really good. And as you said, no one else knows what that felt like. There's only a small number of you who know what it's like to be inside that gang.
Yeah.
And you've made your friends.
Yeah.
And it's about friends.
Yeah, yeah.
What a magical thing to have done.
No, I know. I mean, I feel tremendously lucky, you know, to have met the other guys as we did, you know, all that time ago, but particularly with Ghosts, because it never felt because we've been lucky in having done a number of things, and each of them have worked in their own terms. Like with the popularity of Ghosts, it was, this is BBC One prime time, and that's really putting it above the parapet. And is this where we take the dive? And it turns out that last thing was the high point. And so to have found the reception that it has was just so unlikely, and it just makes you invest all the more in trying to preserve it. Because of course the other thing with Ghosts that's sort of baked into the format is the sense that those characters are unchanging, and in every sense, but also physically. And at what point do you go, that guy doesn't look like Lady?
Again, you've got a thing that their time is locked. Like Friends, the situation is they can't keep on playing those characters as they get older. There's an immediate end point coming up, which is change. There's some stuff in Ghosts about life changes that's coming in, and those life changes for the humans and for the ghosts, the fact that they're possible for the humans and impossible for the ghosts is the tragedy of being a ghost. One of the things about Ghosts that's really clever is that any interruption to the stasis is to do with being alive, because the ghosts fantasize about change, about simple things that we take for granted, hunger and life and death. Change means that it won't be as good as it was, because the reason you're still watching it five seasons in is you liked episode one. And the basically point is, anything that people are like, I want this to happen, I want that to change. Well, you don't want the characters to look different, you don't want Jennifer Aniston to get older, you don't want the performers to change, you don't want the characters to change, you don't want anything to change. You want the fantasy that things will stay the same forever. That doesn't happen in drama. Drama is all about change. Sitcom offers a chance for things to always be the same. it's the high point of the art form, and you do it by recording it so that, as we've done with Friends, you can watch it again and again and again and go back to episode one.
Yeah.
And even if you watch episode 146, it still feels a bit like episode one if the sitcom succeeded. Yeah, yeah. And we've got this thing where I can watch Friends at any point and be back where I was when I watched it. It's an amazing thing to leave, that it's not got motion in it. It's got stasis. Everyone fantasizes about their friendships never changing.
Yeah.
Than being preserved at the moment you were happiest.
There was something really, as you know, we did a preview of the final series at the BFI, and a couple of people there who work for the BFI, and one of them is their in-house television historian, who's a fascinating guy to talk to, because obviously there is nothing he doesn't know about anything that's ever been in history. And someone who was there sort of asked what he was doing, whether he was a fan of Ghosts. You know, thankfully said that he was, and he really, you know, really enjoyed watching the show. And I said, well, not really under your remit. And he went, we'll be by Christmas. And I was like, oh, God, yeah.
Oh, my God.
It's yours then.
Yeah. It passed into an archive.
It's a bit of telly history. And that, you know, that's what it is. Just hearing that from someone like him, I was like, wow, that's giving me a lump in the throat.
But you did it. I talked about this with people before. One of the things that I love about talking about sitcoms and people who love sitcom is that the best sitcoms are an act of love for the form. Mm. They're about faith in this form working, about comedy being worth doing well. Yes. And the holy grail for everyone of our generation was people challenged. He said, can you do a BBC One sitcom that's good? And the challenge for those guys who did Friends is, can you do a mainstream, glamorous, massively syndicated sitcom that's really good?
Mm.
And I think that's what they've got in common. They're really good.
I think as well, there's something, you know, one of the things we always tried to find in Ghosts was warmth. And I think a lot of that comes from, I know, you know, obviously the format of the podcast and talking about Comfort Blanket as being things that you go back to. I think part of the reason that I wanted to get into this as a career, and particularly with the tone of something like Ghosts, why it feels like something that's so precious to me and that I sort of want to preserve and not let sort of fade away, was I remember the point in my life where I found Friends. I was at university and I just wasn't very well. As is often the case when people are going to university or being in their late teens, I just got to a point where I'd had a really bad episode of mental health and was suffering terribly with anxiety attacks. And particularly when you're new to these things, you get into this cycle of constantly self-checking and going, am I okay? And as you start to ask yourself that question, the answer is always, no, you're not. You feel bad because you keep asking yourself the question.
Exactly.
And so finding sort of part of the trick until you start getting into, you know, proper therapy and counselling and all the other things which we know help and should be embraced, that initially it's finding things that break that cycle and bring you periods of comfort and relief. And for me, one of the things I found that just worked in a watertight way every single time was watching Friends, because it was escapism and warmth and humour and all the things that were an antidote to how I was otherwise feeling at that period in my life. And I think it's probably meant that I've put an importance in comedy and the value of comedy that might otherwise not have been there for me, because I found it to be profoundly helpful at a time when I felt like I needed help. And it is, you know, it's a silly and trite thing, and it's an entertainment form, and I know that, but it provided a service because of the tone that particular show found that I think is worth having out there. And I think that's why I've always been quite defensive of comedy, and particularly a sitcom, you know, as a format, and why I've always tried to find something that's got a degree of warmth and comfort and lightness and laughter in it, you know, that there's a value in it. And I hope that there are people who, in what can be a very difficult world, particularly as it has been over the last few years, you know, with what we've all had thrown at us, to provide something that's light and fun and a relief. You know, I hope that that our show has done something that Friends did for me when I needed it.
I can't think of any better way to end. That is absolutely beautiful. Thank you for talking. Thank you for the work you've done in the field of excellent sitcom.
Oh, Betsy.
Inspired by our friends. Thanks for bringing friends.
Yeah, pleasure.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Comfort Blanket was presented and produced by Joel Morris for the Cheese and Pickle family of podcasts. Find us on social media and don't forget to like and subscribe.